Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine Podcast Radio. You're about to listen to an episode of Your Everyday Cyber Podcast with Limor Kesem and Diana Kelly. We live in a cyberspace almost all the time, but do we know enough about living in it securely? Join this dynamic duo as they take you through an exploration of daily cyber activities and how you can make better choices to make them secure for yourself and your family. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Welcome to Your Everyday Cyber. I'm Limor Kesem, a cybersecurity professional and advisor to some of the largest corporations in the world, also one toddler's mom. My co-host is Diana Kelly, a cybersecurity expert who is the CTO and co-founder of Security Curve. Today's episode focuses on something we need every day to survive, but often don't give much thought to. It is water. Recent cyber news we came across earlier this month has hit very close to Your Everyday Cyber's community when an attacker attempted to poison the water supply in Oldsmar, Florida. Did you hear about this, Diana?
Oh yeah, Limor, I sure did. And any time that attackers go after services and utilities and things that people depend on every day, it reminds me why I got into cybersecurity in the first place, which is so that people can benefit from technology and advances without having to worry about attackers or criminals impacting their safety. Technology's brought us so many advances in water. You think about smart irrigation systems that ensure water's being used in the most efficient manner for the crops, and smart soda machines where you can mix water and CO2 and flavoring on demand for your perfect drink every time. But as we bring more smart tech to our critical infrastructure, like the water supply, for example, the more we need to protect it.
Yeah, absolutely. We can't survive without water. And there are other services like it that are considered critical to maintaining daily life, like power, transport, healthcare. Those kind of things are targeted by attackers a lot. They are defined as critical infrastructure, and nations put a lot of emphasis to defend them. So when something like this happens, it's kind of crazy. So you can see that this news story about hacking into and then impacting a water quality at a local utility was pretty upsetting for many, which is why we're really lucky to have Mr. Bryson Bort here today with us. He's a cybersecurity expert with vast experience in cyber mission support for national defense, especially where a lot of industrial controls are implemented. And he's here to help explain to us what went on with the attack, what the future of water safety may look like, and what can be done better to help protect public water sources. Welcome, Bryson. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So, I want to start with a quick question. You are the co-founder of something called the ICS Village. Maybe you can give us a few words that kind of introduces you. What is the ICS and why did you create this ICS Village?
So the ICS Village started, I want to say, about 7-8 years ago when a group of technical folks built industrial control system range. So instead of building an entire power plant, you build parts of it to illustrate the different components to educate folks on industrial control systems. Fast forward to today. Tom Van Norman and I turned that into a 501c3 nonprofit with the mission to provide education and awareness on industrial control system security to different folks. We find the challenges to be that there are folks who don't even know what industrial control systems are and how it underpins, as you introduced it, the very way of modern life: water, electricity, transportation. There are, in fact, 16 sector-specific agencies breaking apart all of the components of critical infrastructure to IT professionals who are looking to learn more about the industrial control system environment. So we provide hands-on activities for them to get their feet wet and start to peel back what can seem pretty obscure. The joke that I always make about, well, what is an industrial control system compared to what we're used to seeing in an enterprise information technology environment is any computer that's at least 20 years old is an industrial control system. Like we'll talk about later with what happened in Florida, these are computers that were designed for a long duty cycle. They're meant to be They're expensive. They're meant to be put in place for 20 to 30 years, low maintenance. And the biggest change with them is compared to what we have in an enterprise environment, which is all about data and moving data around, we're talking about computers that affect the physical world, cyber-physical systems that can change what physically manifests in our reality.
So, Bryson, given your deep expertise in the industrial control space, could you provide a little bit of an overview of what happened in Oldsmar?
Sure. As with all of these, more information continues to come out. So the short summary of what happened is somebody logged in through a remote application called TeamViewer. TeamViewer is pretty common in enterprise IT, and it's also pretty common in industrial control systems. Because in the case of Oldsmar, this is a water plant that's serving 15,000 residents, and you only have a couple of people running it. And so the ability to remotely monitor and administer things is typically commonplace in a lot of these kinds of municipal water plants, power plants, and different things, so that limited resources and engineers can serve a wider area. How they got into TeamViewer, there was a cyber hygiene question of, it was one common password that was not shared. We know there was not multi-factor authentication on it. There's potentially proof that the password had been leaked online several months earlier, which of course means that any number of parties could have had access to it. Once they logged in with TeamViewer, they were able to move over and change the amount of sodium hydroxide that was supposed to be recycled into the water to condition it, to treat it, to make it safe to drink. Sodium hydroxide is a lie. And the good news here is that, one, this happened during business hours, so the operator was able to see this and stop it. Two, the amount that it was set to was probably physically impossible to achieve. It would have still potentially approached dangerous levels, but not something that would have hit that amount. And the other secondary defense is that water that was treated would go into storage for a 24 to 36 hour period where it would be manually tested afterward. And so they would have definitely identified through manual testing safety that it had been contaminated and would not have put it into the water supply.
Scary. And I was doing a little bit of reading about this, and I saw that there are 54,000 different drinking water facilities in the United States, but that each one of those is managed by local governments or small companies hired by those local governments and municipalities. So is that right, Bryson, what I read? And also, does that mean that there's no federal standard for water management? Should we be worried that there's no federal standard?
So the Environmental Protection Agency is the SSA, the sector-specific agency for water. And they do put out federal regulations and guidance. And technically, cybersecurity does fall under the EPA for the water plants. As you can imagine, they don't have many resources to do anything about that. You are correct. There are that many different installations. And from a legal perspective, they are managed that way because the way that the laws work in the United States is federal government, in this case, would only have jurisdiction if something went across state lines. We were talking before the show about ERCOT in Texas, and that is how ERCOT has avoided federal regulation, is because it only is inside the state of Texas.
Okay. So thinking back to, you were talking about that TeamViewer machine and, you know, being able to access it remotely. Looking at those risks, why would there be an open remote connection in an industrial control, you know, a water facility, something that, you know, a service utility that we depend on, like water or electricity? Why would you open that up to remote access if there's such a risk of an attacker being able to connect in?
So, of course, everything is a risk model, whether you realize it or not, whether it's conscious or not. And in this case, it's convenience. It's the plant is not resourced where, if you think about the need to have 24/7 monitoring, that having somebody in that plant all the time is feasible. An example that I use in my classes when I teach IoT security is in 2015, a casino was hacked for millions of dollars as damages. And the way that they got in was a thermometer in a fish tank. Okay, why was there a remotely accessible thermometer in a fish tank? Because going in every single day at all these times to physically check the temperature of that water in that fish tank, that doesn't make sense. That's not efficient. So having it remotely accessible where I can monitor it and only go in when I need to, so dispatching resources, is capitally efficient and or capital efficient. And that same principle is what applies throughout all of these elements of critical infrastructure. If you think about in particularly with power, having to cover a large service area, you can't have everybody everywhere. So you need the ability to remotely sense and understand and interact with what's happening. I believe that, I believe in this case with Oldsmar that they did not consider the risk. Obviously, sharing a password is a bad practice that I'm sure all of our listeners know. But when you're in that kind of setting, you don't consider, well, I don't think somebody's really going to do this. And this is just more convenient for the few of us that do, in fact, have to do this to be able to do our jobs.
That's some crazy stuff for sure. Who do you think is behind these types of efforts? I mean, you know, would you say from your experience that water supply and all those critical infrastructures are a target for nation state adversaries?
So it's always risky doing speculation from an armchair. I think that the Oldsmar attacker was probably an amateur. It could have been a disgruntled former employee, or it could have been somebody who just saw an open application on Shodan or Census and said, I wonder what that does. And they got in. And then the next thing you know, we're in like the 1983 movie War Games. And it's like, do you want to play a game? And I'm going to do something. And I don't really consider the consequences of it. I mean, all of the hallmarks of the tradecraft that was used would indicate somebody at that level. When it comes to nation states, I'm a former Army officer. And this is where I put everything into that the world of cyber is not just about cyber. It's not just a game of nerds and bits. It's there's a larger nation state chessboard here with lots of levers at play, and cyber is just one component. What I believe has been happening for years in critical infrastructure has been that our adversaries have been conducting active reconnaissance, mapping iteratively, learning the systems, learning the responses, but not wanting for the most part to actually do anything. And the reason for that is that when there's so much debate about what's that red line in cyber that would invite a military response, I think the loss of life or limb that we could directly attribute to a nation state attack on an area, the response would be a military one. And that is what has curtailed anything from that. However, I believe that they have been trying to put those levers in place so that they have those, in quote, cyber military options in the future.
I mean, should we be worried about what comes out of our taps, or should we just kind of think that this, you know, doesn't happen a lot and we shouldn't be as worried about it?
Yeah, this doesn't happen a lot. So going back to the nation state calculus that I was talking about, that's not, I don't think, a primary risk, because the consequences will be a drastic reprisal. This is tough because critical infrastructure is something we depend on, and there's not much we can do about it, right? We, as smart, as talented, as many resources as we as individuals might have in us or around our homes, there's not a lot that most of us can do if there's no mass power, if there's no water. I mean, you can only get so far. And so we really do have to depend on these public goods being delivered to us.
So Bryson, you know, is there anything that you would recommend that either the local utilities are doing more of, or, you know, as citizens, is this something that we should be talking to our politicians about and, you know, so saying, hey, we understand that our electricity and our water are, you know, potentially at risk, and we'd like you to be investing more in the cybersecurity and protection. I mean, what do you think as listeners, what should we be doing to make sure that we're trying to help and support, you know, having clean drinking water for our families?
Conveniently, Rob Kanacki, who is former National Security Counsel in the Obama White House, and I just wrote an op-ed last week on that topic. So after this happened, we got together and started saying, let's begin to advocate for several policy positions to improve this. Again, going back to your earlier question about what is the role of federal government in this, that's where things can get a little tricky. We saw this with election security. It takes time to build state, local, territorial, and tribal trust with federal government and working all those pieces out. But one of the things that I have believed in for some time, and I first advocated it publicly a couple of years ago at the CISA summit, where I was on a panel with Leslie Carhart, moderated by Jonathan Homer, is that I believe that when we look at the challenges for the local level of industrial control systems in critical infrastructure, most of these folks, I mean, almost all of them, are not what we would call cyber people. They are more like safety engineers, mechanical engineers who work to make machinery go and operate. And the cybersecurity implications of the increasingly computerized environment of that is something that everybody is still catching up to. I liken it to the way we as an industry thought about computers in the 90s. Like that's kind of where we're at. It's still almost kind of like, well, that's a thing. And so where I think the federal government can help here is it's not that we need more regulation. Paper doesn't solve problems, right? You can put anything on paper. You need the resources to do something about it. And those resources are increased funding, training, and of course, it'd be great that that could help with personnel, but you can't just create a trained workforce out of nothing. So that's something that's going to take longer to do. But the other aspect is that I think that with the increasing growth of CISA, hopefully some more consolidation under CISA for cybersecurity responsibilities domestically, that not that they're going to go and manage all of these things, but that they can save time by providing more like a service catalog of products, configurations, and things that folks don't have to go and research 54,000 times over for their own water plant, but that they can take pieces of it and go, okay, well, I have that kind of equipment. I have that kind of software. I just have to download this stuff. Some of it I can install. Some of it I need to just implement, but that they've taken that guesswork out of it.
I agree. This is really good advice. And of course, yeah, there's resources to show them of, you know, if you're operating this kind of remote access to your plant, you have to review what kind of stuff is open and close it and kind of have processes in place that make sure that it doesn't happen. And I definitely think this is really good advice for them. So thank you so much, Bryson, for being with us today and helping our listeners understand what happened at Oldsmar and that these things are becoming a reality. And also, basically, that there is no need to panic about our water supply safety. And thank you all our listeners for being with us today again. Please follow the podcast and get involved. You can reach out to us on Twitter, and it is at cyber_everyday. We're on LinkedIn, and if you wish to send us some questions in advance to suggest topics for upcoming episodes, you can email us at youreverydaycyber@securitycurb.com. Our podcast page has more details for you and resources for each and every one of our episodes. So thank you everyone for tuning in, and stay safe out there.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Your Everyday Cyber Podcast with Limor and Diana. If you learned something new and this conversation made you think, then share ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Thank you.